in Tunisia, one of my favorite tunes, with the Latin great Mario Bauza with his Afro-Cuban jazz orchestra. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it's Thursday, February the 21st. And a mixed bag of lessons today. We are going to be highlighting three cautionary tales. Bulgarians show what government by the people, for the people really means. Sequestration may in fact have a huge unintended benefit if you could do the math. And in Chicago, a Jackson family implosion. Well, let's go to Bulgaria, where we get our first lesson. A promise of prosperity had fueled the overthrow of communism in Bulgaria in 1989. But since then, and under successive administrations, there has been wave after wave after wave of austerity measures, cutbacks, unemployment, and high taxes, all to avoid having to seek an international bailout like Hungary and Romania did, according to the government. Bulgarians took to the streets. They said they had had it with corruption and irresponsible decisions by government that were making the people suffer. Feel familiar? Sound familiar? When state-controlled electricity rates went up, way up, they upped the ante on protest. They upped the volume and they upped the frequency of protests nationwide, the largest seen in recent memory. Thousands burned their utility bills. Things took a bad turn last week, where bloody clashes were the order of the day between protesters and police. On Monday, Finance Minister Simeon Diankov, the man seen as the force behind Bulgaria's severe fiscal policies, stepped down. It was meant to stop the protests and calm the people, but it only energized the movement. Then this happened yesterday.
Across Bulgaria, tens of thousands of people have protested for several days over high electricity prices. This is the poorest country in the European Union. Outside Parliament in Sofia, people demanded the renationalisation of power distribution companies. The scale of the protests seems to have forced the government's hand. And so, Prime Minister Boyko Borisov told Parliament that he and his entire government were resigning.
I can't watch as fences go up around Parliament. If the people want the government to resign, then the state needs a new vote of confidence. So the people will decide how the government continues from now on. What democracy stands for worldwide is elections.
This is the latest administration in Europe to be forced out of office by a popular backlash against austerity measures and the high cost of living. Electricity prices rose by 13% last summer. Bulgaria's election is 4 months away. Some sort of interim government will now be formed, but the outgoing Prime Minister says his party won't have any further role in the country's administration. Bernard Smith, Al Jazeera.
The people gave us power, and today we are returning it, Prime Minister Borisov said yesterday to Parliament when he announced that he and his entire Parliament were resigning. Every drop of blood for us is a stain, he said. I can't look at a parliament surrounded by barricades. That's not our goal, neither our approach, if we have to protect ourselves from the people. So, what lesson have we learned there? You'll be able to tell me when we open up for comments. It is interesting that people take this business of government quite seriously and democracy quite seriously, not the theoretical definition of democracy, but the actual practice of it. And here is yet another example of people being very, very serious about the irresponsibility of government that, in fact, was in turn inflicting all the suffering. In the United States, people don't have that kind of courage, not yet, to confront a government that isn't doing anything. For 4 years, we haven't seen movement in this government, and it looks like year five is shaping up to be in the same pattern of getting absolutely nothing done. Lots and lots of noise, but no activity really in the interests of the people. So the question is, how committed are we? By now, there should have been a vote of no confidence in this administration. Nothing personal, but yes, it's personal. There should have been by now a sweeping movement challenging this government's inactivity, inability to get something done. But, you know, we're kind of soft. We just don't like confrontation at that level. We prefer to just kind of go with the flow. And in the meantime, what we see and what we are getting, this version of democracy, which is completely unpalatable, we tolerate it because we don't want to get that much exercised in making sure that this government actually understands that there's a power equation between them and the people. They are to be the people executing policies in behalf of the people. They're not an authority unto themselves. Well, the Pentagon yesterday sent Congress its legally required official notification that it plans to furlough the vast majority of its civilian workforce in the second half of fiscal 2013. Now, that starts immediately a 45-day clock before the Pentagon can begin imposing furloughs on 780,000 civil servants. And that would start in late April, unless Congress acts quickly to stop automatic across-the-board cuts. The furloughs will save about $4 to $5 billion in the current fiscal year, but that is just a fraction of the $46 billion that would have to be made up if sequestration stays in effect. Naturally, the threat to cuts to the military are no joke to the military. Here's how General Martin Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, put it.
Implemented.
Operations, maintenance, and training will be gutted. We'll ground aircraft, return ships to port, and sharply curtail training across the force. As the Secretary mentioned, we may be forced to furlough civilians at the expense of maintenance and even health care. We'll be unable to reset the force following a decade of war. Our readiness will begin to erode. Within months, we'll be less prepared. Within a year, we'll be unprepared.
Last year, when Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta spoke at the 11th Asia Security Summit that was held in Singapore, he was asked by the chairman of the summit, Francois Heisberg, whether a declining economy, rising unemployment, the general impasse in Congress between the Democrats and Republicans would endanger U.S. military obligations. Panetta called the impasse an artificial crisis. Here's what he said.
First of all, understand that it was the United States Congress taking the first step to try to deal with the debt issue that developed the Budget Control Act. And that part of the Budget Control Act that related to defense required that we cut $487 billion out of defense over the next 10 years. Because of my own background as OMB director and as chairman of the House Budget Committee, I have always believed that defense has to do its role with regards to fiscal responsibility in the United States. And it was for that reason that we made the decision that we would take that number and develop a strategy, a defense strategy, that would implement those savings over the next 10 years, but would do it in a way that would be tied to a defense strategy that would maintain our military power in the world. And working with the service chiefs, working with the undersecretaries, we developed that strategy and we developed the budget that would meet those goals. So I do not think that we have to choose, obviously, between our national security or fiscal security. I think we can do both. And I've always believed that. And I think we have done it with regards to the proposal we've made. So number one, the plan that we developed, the strategy that we developed, and the budget we developed implements those reductions over a period of time, but does it in a responsible way that protects our defense posture for the future. We recognize that. I think the Congress recognizes that as well. Secondly, with regards to sequester, sequester is not a real crisis. It's an artificial crisis. The Congress itself developed that as a weapon to try to force them to make decisions with regards to further deficit reduction. And they put that gun to their head to basically say if they didn't do it, they would the gun would go off. It's been set because of the failure of the super committee. Sequester is now supposed to take effect in January. Both Republicans and Democrats recognize that would be a disaster. Sequester would impose another $500 billion in defense cuts if it were to go into effect. I know of no Republican, no Democrat who believes that should happen. Having said that, obviously they have the responsibility then to take action now to de-trigger sequester from taking effect. I believe that they will work to do that. I really do, because I think there isn't anyone that wants that to happen. So I'm confident that ultimately Republicans and Democrats will find a way to de-trigger that artificial crisis that they put in place. The third point is with regards to the confidence level I have that ultimately Republicans and Democrats will deal with the larger issues that we confront in our economy, particularly with regards to the deficit. In my history in the Congress, I participated in every budget, major budget summit, beginning with Reagan, President Reagan, continuing with President Bush, and as OMB director for President Clinton, developed the budget, the deficit reduction plan that President Clinton put in place. In every one of those, it was important for Republicans and Democrats to put everything on the table and to look at every area of spending, not just defense, not just domestic spending, but at entitlements and at revenues. And it was because we put all of those elements together in those packages that we ultimately were able to balance the budget. I know the politics of this is difficult, both for Republicans and Democrats, but I ultimately believe that because it is so important to our country and to our economy, that ultimately they will find the courage that is required here to be able to develop that kind of approach to deficit reduction.
Well, an artificial crisis. An artificial crisis is what we are experiencing, says Leon Panetta. And he's addressing the Asia Security Summit in Singapore just last year. And he is a former director of the Office of Management and Budget. And therefore, I would presume he isn't lying to the world. I presume when he's speaking to leaders and telling them this is what it is, it's an artificial crisis, it must really be an artificial crisis. But it seems pretty real if you look at the coverage and if you hear the strains coming from the Democrats and Republicans and they telling the people, hey, this is going to happen, it's doom and gloom, the sky is falling. But you heard him say that the budget, the defense budget, already has been articulated in such a way that it can sustain and will and should sustain cuts. But that's not the story we're hearing. So if you pay attention to the media coverage about it, if you pay attention to the back and forth between Democrats and Republicans, between the president and the Congress and the generals and the military people, you will get a sense that is completely different from what we just heard from Leon Panetta's own mouth just last year. But not to worry. The Cato Institute says that sequestration is not necessarily a bad thing, even if it were to happen. It's all about how you do the math. Here's the Cato Institute's analysis of the matter.
Members of Congress say they want to cut spending, and yet time and again they demonstrate they are incapable of doing so.
Congress isn't very good at cutting spending. Overall federal spending has increased dramatically since 2000, and borrowed spending has increased at an even faster rate.
Even the budget that was just passed out does not conform to the limits that they set for themselves just last year.
The Budget Control Act passed last year gave Congress a few choices: cut spending now or delegate spending cuts to a super committee. If that committee failed to agree on spending cuts, then across the board, budget cuts known as sequestration would automatically kick in.
If we have a sequester, this horrible draconian process, government spending 10 years from now will be $2 trillion higher instead of $2.1 trillion higher. So all we're doing is shaving the rate of growth of government if you have a sequester.
For military spending, sequestration means a cut of about $55 billion in a single year.
Some defense hawks complain with some legitimacy that they're one-fourth of the budget and yet they're taking one half of the sequester.
Military spending has increased over 90% since 1998, fueled by a decade of spending on wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
It's higher than it's been throughout most of the Cold War, and all we would do under sequestration is go back to about 2006 or 2007 levels, which was already an exceedingly high defense budget. So it's really quite a minor cut after a massive increase.
The cuts under sequestration occur mainly in 2013. After 2013, the budget starts to climb again.
You're still talking about the defense budget being $100 billion higher 10 years from now than it is today.
Military spending typically does decline after wars. After Korea, Vietnam, and the Cold War, military spending fell considerably.
As a country grows wealthier, it should be able to spend a smaller share of its wealth on defense, especially if the threats decline, as they have since the end of the Cold War.
In addition to extended military campaigns since the end of the Cold War, the United States has expanded its defense of other countries.
We could be spending considerably less at no loss to U.S. security. If anything, our spending so much undermines our security because it causes our allies to grow dependent upon us spending on their behalf.
Allies in NATO, for example, have in total a larger population and higher GDP than the U.S. But the U.S. devotes its own considerable resources to defending these countries that are able to defend themselves.
I believe that if we were to spend less and to use our power less, other countries would be encouraged to spend more and to defend themselves and their interests. And the end result is less burden on American taxpayers, but ultimately greater security for all.
As wars in Afghanistan and Iraq come to an end, only sequestration provides a likely scenario for reducing military spending.
It simply does what politicians refuse to do, which is to somewhat slow the growth of federal spending.
So, what is the lesson here? The lesson here is it all depends on who's doing the math, or the lesson here could be to prevent sequestration. Why not just declare a war? We'll take a break and come back to the Jackson dynasty crumbling right after this. is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. Right here, I hope you're spreading the word about PRN.FM. Tell people that they've got to tune in, as you do. Yesterday, in federal court in Washington, D.C., former Congressman, Illinois Congressman, Jesse Jackson Jr. pleaded guilty to a single count of conspiracy. And the conspiracy involved acting in concert with his wife, Sandy Jackson, using or misusing more than $750,000 in campaign funds for his own benefit. Later yesterday, same day, also in federal court, his wife took her turn, and she also did plead guilty on account of filing false tax returns. Jackson appeared to be extremely contrite and in tears told the court that he was sorry. He used the money, he said, for personal purposes. And for years, I lived off of my campaign, he said. Well, they're expected to be sentenced soon, in a matter of weeks. But this is a really incredible story. Because here was a young man who was on the upward swing in political life. He certainly had the added advantage of being the son of the Reverend Jesse Jackson. And in Chicago, that counts for something. In fact, he was elected to another term after serving 17 years when he abruptly resigned for health reasons back in November, saying that he had a mood disorder and was in treatment for severe depression. But a 22-page statement that the federal government filed against the Jacksons talked about the lavishness of their lives and what they spent the campaign money on. I mean, some of the most bizarre things, you know, Jackie Chan's hat and stuffed elk heads to put on a wall and insane items just for the conspicuous consumption, fur coats and so forth. And I hate to say it, but it harkens back to a stereotypical view that the money would be spent not on education for your children, but on fur coats and Rolex watches. Hysterical. Hysterical. But when they come up for sentencing, Jesse Jackson Jr. faces about between 46 and 57 months in prison, and his wife, who will be sentenced on July the 1st, Jesse Jackson Jr. will be sentenced on the 28th, may face up to 2 years in prison. Now, two things. Looking back, one sees the connection between the onset of mental illness and a thing called a defense, a legal defense. The mere outlandishness of the spending, I fully suspect his lawyers will claim when they appeal to the court for a lesser sentence, that those very actions, those very purchases, outlandish as they were an expression of his mental illness. Had he been of sound mind, he never would have spent that kind of money on such useless and frivolous things, you see. But being deeply depressed as he was, and being beset by this alternate world that he occupied, it might have been unclear which Jackson was in operation at the time that they tendered the campaign credit card for these purchases. It is going to be very interesting to watch the legal argument made that there is a link between Jesse Jackson Jr.'s alleged mental condition and his campaign finance violations. Similarly, it would be interesting to see how Mrs. Jackson explains it. This is a story also about the brazenness, just brazen, in your face. I've got the power, I could do anything I want. And to some degree, people would be conciliatory about that if they delivered for their constituencies, but that's not the case. In fact, Mrs. Jackson, who is an alderman, an elected alderman in the city of Chicago, wasn't even living in the district. It was not glamorous enough. The south side of Chicago held no glamour for Mrs. Jackson. Washington, D.C. was the end place, and there she took up residence and spent lavishly on draperies and interior decoration and elk heads. Who in their right mind wants an elk head on a wall? But the children as well, they would not dare be sent to Southside Chicago schools. And when people were saying, you know, those children actually do go to school in Washington, people said, you gotta be kidding. But it happens to be true. So the brazenness of all of this, in your face, I've got it like that. I don't have to worry. My dad is Jesse Jackson. And that gives me a lot of wiggle room. But here is where father and son, and now daughter-in-law, share a common bond. And that is a nasty habit of taking ownership of things that just don't belong to you. In the case of the senior, Jesse Jackson, the two-time presidential candidate, Jesse Jackson, you might have heard me say it here 500 million times, but we still have to determine how the Rainbow Coalition was purloined. Where did it say, on which piece of paper was it transferred to Jesse Jackson as his personal property? I hold that against those folks, those well-meaning liberal folks, grassroots folks, folks interested in the collective advance of a new group of people speaking in behalf of the downtrodden. And this movement was taken possession of by Jesse Jackson Sr. And it's not that he's doing anything with it. He's not organizing anybody. But it does look good on stationery when, as a kind of indirect threat, you send out letters and notes to Fortune 500 companies, just noting the fact that they ought to be more committed to affirmative action, and the Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Push organization would be happy to assist in that, of course, for a little fee. So all around, the sense of entitlement in the most perverse way. And that is Jesse Jackson Sr.'s bequest to Jesse Jackson Jr. And Mrs. Jackson has been bitten by the same bug. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. So we saw three things today that seem completely unrelated to each other, but in fact have a common theme. The common theme is, if our community If we say we are concerned and we are progressive and we are committed, how come we are letting all these things happen and we give all this room, all this wiggle room? We forgive this, we forgive that. We're forgiving Barack Obama the fact that this administration is not accomplishing much. We forgive Congress. We forgive the Democrats. We forgive the Republicans, because if we didn't, we'd be out in the street. Hello, Patricia. You're on the air. Thank you for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Utrice. I was actually calling in to comment on the fate of Jesse Jackson Jr., and I certainly would reject his defense of mental illness. I mean, there are people who do suffer from mental illness, which is a debilitating illness, and I do not believe that Jesse Jackson is one. Unfortunately, as you have already commented, he is a product of his mentor and father, Jesse Sr., I'm talking about now, has mm-hmm. suffered from the arrogance of gluttony for almost 30 years now. And Jesse Jackson essentially has been morally tainted for over 20 years. And unfortunately, that has been the role model for his son, his daughter-in-law, and of course, that group now includes Al Sharpton with the Madison Avenue Collective. You know, unfortunately, white America understands that, in fact, African Americans really don't have leaders who are loyal to them, that they all have a price, and they just have to figure out what that price is, because they're always ready to meet the price. So, unfortunately, people like Jesse identified a number, and white America met the price. And unfortunately, you know, the African American community, we are so desperate. We are just so desperate for leaders that we're just not able to see those who are loyal to themselves and not to us.
But, you know, I have to insist that it isn't just white America that it's met Jesse Jackson's price. For him, it's the price. It doesn't matter where it comes from. The idea is, as long as, let me put it this way. There are many who were in the civil rights movement and still are in the so-called civil rights movement, who believe that they are entitled to commodify the civil rights movement, to monetize it, to put a price on their involvement. Their feeling of entitlement stems from the position that I was there. I had my head busted. I was there. I was marching. I was in the thick of it. And I put in my requisite energy. And now it's time for me to be rewarded.
Well, you know, Utrice, John Henry Clark always said African-American leaders should have two qualities, one of loyalty and one of sacrifice. And neither of those apply to any of those individuals.
Amen.
Have a good day.
Thank you. 888-874-4888. This is how we start to take a look at these little things are happening all over the place, and they appear to be disjointed, but they really have, they're saying something, and you have to just dig underneath and figure out what is it that they're trying to say? What is it that I'm supposed to come away with? What is another way of understanding what is presented to me as the reality? The reality in the Jesse Jackson case is a straight cut and dried thing. Here's a guy, he did something wrong, he admitted it, he's going to be punished. But no, it is also about the generational effect of misrepresentation, the generational effect of saying, it is me first. And in some cases, it is me only. And your south side of Chicago is put on the auction block, and all of the south sides of Chicago that are all around the nation put on the block by leadership that has as its primary objective the gratification of self. John from Charleston, thank you so much. You're with us.
Hello, Utrice.
Hello.
I enjoy your program. And
thank you.
I was just calling about the Jackson thing. I mean, they all just end up doing the same thing. They never learn. They just think they can get away with just anything when they get up in their little power, so-called. But anyway, I was just calling to vent my opinion on that. And the other thing I want to say is this. Am I on?
Yes, yes, yes. I'm listening very intently.
Oh, the other thing I want to say is this person who comes on before you is totally disrespecting you. He goes into your show, I mean, every single day, and I don't know why you let him get away with that.
Well, he's Gary Null. That's Gary Null. He's the founder of Progressive Radio Network. Yes, I understand where you're coming from, but sometimes it is because, and we do this in radio a lot, sometimes you give them the courtesy only because the subject matter is registering and people want to listen.
He should take 2 hours if that's what he wants. Don't go into your show. You need your time just like he does. But anyway, that's just my opinion. I'm sure other people have the same opinion about it, but either you should try to get another spot.
Thank you so much for contributing today. 888-874-4888. You know, it's very often in the radio business, and it's a kind of a courtesy that we extend each other when we are doing programs that are, you know, in full force, and to just end it would make the program suffer a little bit. So we give each other a little bit of wiggle room, and it's a courtesy we afford each other. Thank you so much. So this is a matter that we have to pay attention to, and Patricia, you were quite right. In our communities, we accept this as, you know, it's okay. We give them the benefit of the doubt. We give them a lot of compassion and a lot of understanding because they were there in the day. They were with Martin. They were on the vanguard of the movement, if you will. And it is true. No one could deny that Jesse Jackson was not a part of this. That he was, I should say, a part of this. He was a part of this movement, and he did. But so did many others. But people can see that there has been this. There is this pattern. I was there, therefore. And it is a pattern in public life. I mean, just yesterday we read that Hillary Clinton has signed up for Speaker's Bureau, and her speaking fees will be in the six figures. And that's how they make money. They position themselves to capitalize on the experience attached to them, which they think is merchandisable. To some degree, like I said, you can't avoid that, but you look at the consistency of the effort. In our communities, I think it's a great thing if somebody reaches a point where people value their opinion and would want them to come and speak, and they would want them to do these kinds of things. But in our movement called the Civil Rights Movement, the latter-day Civil Rights Movement, we see this commercialism. We see this entrepreneurial spirit that is vicious, that is self-centered, that it is all about how can I parlay my experience? How can I make that make tons and tons of money for me? This is the consistent pattern. And then you see the relationship between that kind of thinking and the state of affairs in these desperate, distressed communities. This is what is upsetting me. People are depending on good leadership, but the leadership is all consumed with itself. Michael, thank you for joining us today from New Jersey.
Oh, hi, Retrieves. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
I don't want to take this too much in a different direction, but I think maybe for another show I can contribute something as a topic. I heard something from another producer on the network talking about democracy and capitalism. And the argument was that they're really antagonistic. that they don't work together, they don't go together. We just, in America, assume that they're part of one thing. America, democracy, capitalism, it all goes together. But the gentleman gave a very great argument that they don't go together at all. In fact, they're totally antagonistic. And it seems, even in what we're talking about today, that capitalism has trumped democracy. Because democracy is, you know, spread amongst the many, and capitalism is obviously it's concentrated into the very few who control. So, and also capitalism now has really overtaken democracy and our government, actually.
Well, you know, this is why I stay away from ideological arguments, and I'll tell you why. Because, you know, I could appreciate what the person was laying out, but we do not live in a democracy. We live in a republic. Democracy is the theoretical framework within which our republic operates. So people say all the time, we live in a democracy. No, we don't. We live in a republic. Democracy is simply the means of governance that we talk about all the time, being that people should have relatively equal access to the throttle and brake of government, which is why government is centered at one place and its ambassadors are representing these different constituencies in the House and in the Senate. So on that very simple basis, when people call, you know, I don't know what the argument is, that democracy and capitalism, because I asked a question some time ago on this program. If you're not for capitalism, what are you for? And it's okay to tell us what they're against. That's great. I'm interested in what are you for? So I ask you, Michael, what are you for?
Well, you know, the way things have seemed to have been working, ideally, if there could be a democracy, then that's what I would be for. But a democracy depends on a relationship between people. And there has to be order in the relationship between people, individuals on a macro level and on a micro level.
Well, you see, if you're talking about the relationship between people, and if you accept that the very founding of this country discouraged the relationship between people for economic reasons, that's what we dealt with here in the presentation, The Invention of the White Race. The idea was that it was economics that was very important. And it made no distinction between who was white and who was black initially, until it became a political weapon. It became politically feasible to do so. So if we accept, and this is, again, this is a little schism, people saying this assume that the races, for lack of a better term, you know what I mean by that, people of different ancestries can get along. That's not how this country was designed. So to suggest that it is not part of the condition for something to be successful is itself to be living in an unrealistic world. If you're going to argue about it, the first thing you have to deal with is, how are you going to compensate? How are you going to account for the impact and influence of racism, which is itself a division in the so-called democracy that they say they are for? That's a normal conundrum that we encounter all the time. The assumption that theories would be fine, but when we have to examine for internal contradictions, That's where we get stumped all the time. Oh, that means we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining me today. And let's do it again tomorrow at 1 o'clock. In the meantime, pass the word and continue the conversation at leadstories@gmail.com. Thank you so much for the pleasure and privilege of your company. Bye-bye.